I'm sure we'll be joined by members of the House and Senate in a little while. I want to introduce, this is an oversight meeting today, so we really don't need a quorum on either side to start, so we're just going to go ahead and get started and understand you all have busy schedules. This is a House and Senate Joint Transportation Oversight Meeting. I'd like to introduce members of the Senate that are here today. We have Senator Huggins here with us today and Senator Joe Thomas from Fairbanks. And I'd like Representative Peggy Wilson to introduce members of the House that are here, if she would.
Okay, thank you. Senator Kukesh, Representative Feige, Representative Peterson, and myself, Wilson, are all present.
How many cookies you got there?
Thank you. What we'll do today then is we have the last Department of Transportation Public Facilities. I don't know who wants to join us in the front here to talk to us beginning. Would you do that, Commissioner? Okay, thank you. And we have an agenda. We all have it in front of us. So why don't we just go ahead, Commissioner, and if you would, for the record, introduce yourself, and let's go ahead and hear from you, if you don't mind.
Well, Senator Kukesh and Representative Wilson, thank you. Mark Lucan, Commissioner for the Department of Transportation Public Facilities. First, let me thank you for agreeing to hold this joint committee meeting so that we can give you an update on the Department of Transportation Public Facilities. I guess I would also recognize our governor for his vision and also for your legislative leadership in providing a healthy capital funding for infrastructure growth, which really ultimately is the underpinning of our economy. One of the statistics that the American Association of Highway Transportation Officers puts out is the fact that 84% of our economy is dependent upon transportation and infrastructure. And I would say that Alaska is no different than any of the other states in that statistic. You know, really is one of the best investments that we can make for our state's future economic health. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you kind of some highlights of our department, and then I'm going to bring in the first team, my deputies, to give you more specific detailed information about the department as it deals with roads and the marine highway system. This year alone, we have a little over $1 billion worth of projects that have been awarded in some stage of planning or construction throughout our state. 524 million in 62 projects in phases in central region, almost 29 million along the marine highway system, 361 million on 70 projects in various phases in northern region, and here, right here in southeast, 48 projects valued at 141 million are actively in, have been awarded and are in some form of construction or will be beginning construction in the spring. And ultimately, you know, these are real jobs that this provides for Alaskans, not just high-paying construction jobs, but there are suppliers and support services that are linked to construction. There's also a multiplying factor that spins off from the spending and, even more importantly, the infrastructure that is then in place that facilitates commerce. Transportation is what allows us freedom of movement and access. That is how we get back and forth to work. It is how products get to market. It's how we access health care and visit our families. Transportation allows us to get out to a park, ride a bike along a smooth path, and it provides transit and delivers our fuel. Whether we travel by air or by sea or on the ground, we can't do it without our airports, our docks and harbor facilities, our ports, and our roads, our transportation infrastructure, ultimately. If you look at this map, what you'll see is that, you know, not only are we producing jobs, but we're producing them all over the state. And what the blue is indicative of are the projects that were awarded in 2011, and the red is what we anticipate to award in this next calendar year, 2012. They cross the spectrum from urban to rural, north, south, east, and west, really cover the state. There are airport improvements, resurfacing of highways, retrofitting of buildings for energy efficiency, shoring up docks, adding safety features like pullouts and new lighting along some of our safety corridors. There are trails, airport relocations, rehabilitation of ferries, and building of other facilities. Our work is diverse but we have some of the finest engineers and planners in our state working to create an Alaska that we all can use and appreciate. We are building Alaska efficiently and making it safer. Let me move on to that issue of safety. You know, our safety corridors have been seen a marked improvement in saving lives, and those are primarily oriented around, you know, the large population center of Anchorage, yet that's also where we've had some of the most significant safety issues. But according to our 2010 figures, the number of passengers in Alaska who died because they were not wearing seatbelts dropped from 53% in 2008 to 32% in 2010. Alcohol-related fatalities decreased from 44% in 2008 to 34% in 2010, and the number of people killed in speeding crashes declined from 29 in 2009 to 23 in 2010. We increased the number of traffic officers focused on catching drunk drivers and actually more than doubled from 11 to 26 in 2008. Between 2008 and 2010, and that's really, you know, credited with a good portion of the decline in Alaska's alcohol-related deaths. But I think we also need to recognize the education part of this program and also recognize the willingness of Alaskans to follow safe practices. It's ultimately because they're transitioning more to wearing seat belts, refraining from drinking and driving, that really makes it all work. And we wouldn't have seen results like this without the compliance of Alaska's drivers. Our Alaska Safety Highway Safety Office spent almost $27 million between 2008 and 2010 enhancing highway safety programs that address the four E's of safety: and education, enforcement, engineering, and emergency services. Next, I'd like to just mention, you know, a group of really unsung heroes, in my estimation, in our department, because it's something that is difficult to relate to Department of Transportation, and that's our measurements and standards folks. This small group of folks are responsible for any device that measures commercial activity in our state, whether it's a fuel pump or a scale to weigh fish or a scale to weigh vegetables in the markets. Anything that has to do with measurement and commerce is actually managed by this small group. And what they've done this past year is we've actually gotten out into rural Alaska. And the first communities they visited were King Salmon, Naknek, and Dillingham. And you know, again, we're trying to improve the standardization of commerce and to make sure that we're protecting consumers as well as the commercial businesses as well. And what they found was kind of remarkable. And just to give you two quick instances, they actually found that consumers were shorted about 11.7 gallons of gas for every 100 gallons that were delivered. Which that's, you know, that's pretty significant, and it equates to, you know, an average on a 300-gallon delivery of about $210 for a customer. But on the other side, they also found where a company was delivering 104.7 gallons and only getting paid for 100. So for 1,000 gallons of fuel delivery, that's a roughly, you know, almost a $300 deficit on their side. So the idea being that they are trying to make this beneficial for all of Alaskans. And the great news is that they've managed to build a program that remotely does this in many of our rural communities. And so we should see greater standardization around the state. Again, just all of the things that our department's doing to ultimately be more efficient as an organization, but also create more efficiencies for our state. Finally, I just want to touch on something we're doing within the department, and that's what I would term as policy synchronization. We're trying to take a statewide approach as a department. And this is something I think I mentioned to you last year, was that I saw, you know, in some cases we had four different departments of transportation, and I'm I and my leadership team have spent a lot of time this last year really beginning to gel this organization as a single entity. We want to be more efficient and effective with our customers. And I'll give you a couple of examples. We've instituted an anti-idling policy for just one type of vehicle in the department. It puts a regulator on there, turns the truck off after 10 minutes of idling. We estimate that we can save up to $1 million just for that one vehicle in a year. And ultimately, you know, it saves us on fuel. It leaves a smaller carbon footprint. And ultimately, we can move those funds to updating our vehicle fleet. Just a really great new policy. The other one that I'd like to highlight is a policy of managing the resources we have in our maintenance and operation division and taking a statewide look at those assets when it comes to dealing with surge events, if you will. And the one that I would highlight for you is Cordova just about a month ago. We recognized that storm was coming. We mobilized and actually went out and looked to see where we might have excess capacity around the state and then pulled folks from Ketchikan, from northern region, brought them into Cordova ahead of the storm, and what it allowed us to do is actually keep the roads open the entire time. We kept the equipment running 24/7, and we've formalized that policy. It allowed us to do the same thing last week up in Anchorage when they got hit by about a foot of snow. Again, we brought in extra folks to keep the plows, keep all the equipment running 24/7, and allowed us to keep up with the storm. But that, again, is just an example of how we are taking a look at the assets we have to be more efficient with what we own. I want you to know that you have a Department of Transportation that's available. It's transparent, accountable, and we are becoming more and more innovative every day. So that we can provide superior service around the state. With that, I'll open up for questions, or if you'd like, I'd really like to introduce my deputies. Pat Kemp is the Deputy Commissioner for Roads and Facilities. He'd like to give you a short presentation on the road policies, as well as some other ideas that I think you'll find pretty interesting when it comes to capital improvements.
Well, before we do that, why don't we just see if there's any questions from members of the Joint Committee here. Any questions for Commissioner Lucan? Seeing none, I'm going to ask, thank you very much. If you don't mind just sitting there.
Oh, sure.
We've got a very full room, and I don't think there's a seat back there for you.
Right, okay. I'll sit over here.
So you'll just sit here someplace. That we know there's a chair available for you there.
Sure.
I'd like Representative Wilson to recognize members of the House that have joined us.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grunberg, Representative Munoz, Representative Pruitt have joined us since we started.
You have a question?
Yeah, well, it's a comment.
Yes, sure.
We have a class of close-up students out there, and they're trying to get in to see the presentation, and that's why the young people are coming in. I think we still have some more out there, don't we? Mm-hmm. One more.
Yeah. Well, they're certainly welcome to be here. Yes.
Thank you.
I know.
Because they come from a long way to see.
Don't have to leave. We'll just squeeze over and make room. Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
For the record, my wife's the teacher, so I.
Oh yeah. And to those close.
I couldn't go home tonight.
Yeah. To those close students that are here today, welcome to this is a joint hearing between the House and Senate Transportation Committees, and we're glad that you're here. We appreciate having you. We just heard from the DOT Commissioner, Mr. Lucan, and we're going to right now hear from, did you say you wanted to have, we have an agenda, but we could go to your next Deputy Commissioner if you'd like.
If that's
that's fine with us.
Appropriate
yeah.
or okay with you, I'd love to be able to.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. That would be Pat Kemp. Yes. Oh, there you go. Yeah, it's just change chairs. Okay.
Good afternoon, My name is Pat Kemp. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Transportation. And I thought what we'd start off with today is to take a look at our facilities. We do have the PDF in the DOT also, and that in the facility section is under my purview. We have, according to risk management, we have 726 buildings that they insure. And so we have probably many more buildings. There's a lot of other outbuildings, shacks, and stuff like that. You might see other numbers floating around, like over 800. But 726 is the number we actually zero in on that are maintained by our department. We also take care of the big projects statewide, the construction administration and project development for projects like the Nome State Office Building, the hatcheries, and other buildings throughout the state. The next slide, we'll switch into our Roads to Resources program. I'll give you an update of where we are with each of these projects. The first one on the top is the road to Umiat. We're in the EIS process right now. We're trying to get a scoping report written, and from that scoping report, we will develop a reasonable range of alternatives that we will study in depth. The project is going a little bit slow. We're meeting with the communities up there quite a bit, and there's some real concerns that we have to address as we go through the process.
Excuse me, Mr. Kemp. Excuse me, Mr. Kemp. How do you handle that? I've gotten, and I know maybe other members of the legislature have too. I received probably about five notices of opposition to the road to Umiat. How do you handle that? Do you do public meetings with them, or do you go and meet with their organizations, or how does that work?
Yes, we've had a very involved public involvement program with the communities. We have a group that goes out and meets with them, and we hear their concerns. The thing that's difficult for us right now is that we don't have a lot of information on the project. Uh-huh. We're just trying to get a scoping report written, and what we found. And what the latest, tact is for those in opposition to a project to start raising the flag before you follow the process to a point where you have enough information. In other words, we don't even have a reasonable range of alternatives for this project yet. We don't know anything about the caribou. Well, we know a little bit about the caribou, but we don't have the science for the caribous. We don't have the science for the wetlands. And that comes in the draft EIS. When we do an EIS, the first thing we do is scoping. We go out and ask the communities and the agencies what's range of alternatives, their concerns, things like that. Then we develop a range of reasonable alternatives. After that, we go with a preliminary draft EIS that goes only to the agencies. Then after that, we go and get a draft EIS. And then finally, after that, a final EIS and a record of decision. Well, we're not even through step two yet, or through step one. And for people to come in now opposed, it's kind of a tact we've seen, a pattern we've seen, where you attack the project early and try and chop it off before you get the information out there. We should have a draft EIS out to the public where you can really get your mitts around the project sometime late this year or early next year.
I just want to make a comment, Mr. Kemp. I appreciate that point of view, but the point of view from, at least from the villages where I come from, and the point of view probably from that village, but I'm not really familiar with it, is that they don't want to go so far down the road that you're going to say to them, well, we're too far down the road to turn back or to stop. And I think that's a valid concern from people out in those areas.
Senator Kukesh, I'll assure you there are many many places to stop the process along the way.
Okay, good.
There is the no-build alternatives carried all the way through, mm-hmm. and it's just part of the process. That's why there is such a defined process is to get through these kinds of issues. But we are finding more and more that the projects are trying to be halted before we even get out to the public, and that's something that. You know, we just have to address and go forward with.
Right, we have a question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The opposition that you're sensing coming in from the public, is that driven by people specifically in these communities, or is it coming from other concerned folks outside those communities?
Representative Feige, through the chair, we've heard it both ways. We've heard there's a opposition is mounting, it's getting local communities together to oppose the project, and really it doesn't matter. If we can just keep going through the process, I think it's a fair and honest process, and we should be okay. I mean, rational decisions will be made, and eventually they'll be made in this, in your bodies. So other than that, we do know the issues. We know they're concerned about Caribou. We know they're concerned about road access, which is a derivative of Caribou. And we just have to get the science in front of us and make some decisions.
Okay, thank you. I was just asking the question because it comes up so many times. I want to make sure that you understand that we can't take those lightly. Commissioner Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you take how science-oriented it has to be, but what about in the areas where there are roads and the caribou population has actually increased? I mean, do you look at those type of things, or is it just that's what I'm just kind of wondering about.
Representative Wilson, I'm an engineer, not a biologist. I'm sure they have their means. We do have the top, I believe he's a deputy commissioner for Fish and Game, is actually running the caribou studies. Top-notch fellow, and I'm sure he would take that into account. I've seen the pictures, too, of all the caribou hanging around the pipeline, but that's about the extent I know.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kemp, a couple questions on Klondike IUH. What's IUH?
Representative Gruenberg, through the speaker, or the chair, I'll get to that in just a minute. I'd like to go down to Ambler as the next project. Sure. I'll get into the Klondike.
We can amble
quite
down
a bit. Okay. It's called my trickle down.
Senator Thomas has a question for you. Senator Thomas.
Before you get down to Ambler, and that's what I'm getting at, you know, there seemed to be some confusion last year about the resource itself. You know, we talked about companies that had been in there before in the Umiat area. So my concern is, as you move forward, about the evaluation of the resource that's there, and what indication do you have of what will take place afterwards, after you start building a road? Because there are a variety of other areas that, personally, I see more interest. They're not oil areas, so they may not be potentially as profitable, but my concern is just that, because I know when you guys were looking for money for this project, the Department of Natural Resources was still looking for money to define the resource and where it actually was to help direct. So hopefully you're working hand-in-hand with them to make sure that that's the case, and with the companies that have done some of the exploration work, and also to make sure that it's not just claims of what exists, but there is some realistic information, whether it's seismic or whatever, that actually puts in an OME that's been around for a long time, and they say the oil seeping out of the ground and gas is seeping out, all that. I mean, actually, you know, where we believe that when we build a road like this, that there's going to be somebody come in and that we can pioneer roads or whatever into places, and people will actually take advantage of it. So we start getting some response from the industry to our plans and our building, so we don't misstep, and we also start to realize some basic activity and revenue generated, even if it's not from the resource itself, but that system expected to become an actual mine or a resource development area.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, share your concerns. One of the first things I asked when I came on and viewed this project was, what's the purpose and need to get to Umiat? And it seemed like it was all over the map at first. I talked to DNR officials, I talked to Renaissance officials, and I talked to Link officials. And they're on the oil side. The gas side, we've talked to Anadarko a little bit. We feel the resources are there. We're working with the Corps of Engineers, and there's enough justification for them to move forward with our purpose and need to access the area and to not definitively describe exactly how much oil is in the ground or gas is in the ground. It's known as a resource-rich area. And then there's other parts of the purpose and need. I'm sure you've heard about the 85,000 barrels of old oil that was left in the river up there, and the cleanup is a huge super fund of, I think it was $300-400 million. So there's other aspects to it besides just that. But we think we have a strong purpose and need. As soon as we get a good range of alternatives, I think we'll have pretty good information that we can make good, rational decisions with as we move through.
Yes,
I don't want to take up the whole meeting talking about one particular project, but you know, I just want to make sure, you know, that we really know what we're building it for and what the resource is there, because that's what the title of the funds is, Roads to Resources. So concerns me if we don't have a preponderance of information on the resource, why we concentrate on one over another. I think there should be that evaluation done, and talking to Anadarko, I think is great. Renaissance, I don't know what their plans are, but I mean a real oil company or gas company, I think, and if those folks are serious about what they would do, then I think their statistics, their data should be turned over to the state to further evaluate before we make some decisions. And you know, I'm all in favor of the project. It seems like it stumbled along for a while, and I was surprised at what I determined or thought was the lack of information on the resource. This is my concern.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, one thing I should add is a part of the purpose and need of the project is to take a good look at the entire area as a road is constructed. It's a resource-rich area, and there are resources along the way. And that was, according to DNR, there was a preferred alternative earlier for the Galbraith route that made a diagonal cut through the area that accessed the greatest number of resources. So I mentioned I'm not a biologist, I'm not an oil or a petroleum engineer either. But I believe if the Corps of Engineers is happy with our purpose and need and we get a reasonable range of alternatives, I think the process will just play itself out and we'll see. I know that one last thing. I know that Link was planning on drilling this year, this winter, and that did fall through. There weren't any available drill rigs, so we would have had more information. That's what we heard. So, yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I've got about three questions that I think would be just good to get on the record the answers, because there's. So there are some legitimate concerns, I think, from maybe some of the tribes. Has there been money set aside for permitting at this time?
Madam Chair, no. The permitting comes at the end of the rod.
Okay.
Follow-up? Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Have the other alternatives been decided yet?
Madam Chair, no. That's what we're trying to do now. We're trying to develop a reasonable range of alternatives.
Okay.
And what you'll see with that, as I envision it, and I'm not sure of entirely the core process, but you'll see all the criteria, and then you'll see the impacts. For instance, you'll see wetlands, and then you'll see number of wetlands affected for each criteria. And it's just not the natural science. It would be road mileage. If we use the meltwater route, what's the road mileage via meltwater from say a common denominator like Fairbanks versus the Galbraith route versus pump station 2. So all that criteria is going to be in the mix, and what you do is you try and winnow down the alternatives that you study. I mean, I could come into scoping and I could say, well, I think a good idea is to build a road to the western coast of Alaska, then follow the entire coastline down to Anchorage. Well, you go through the winnowing criteria, and that's going to fall out. And that's what you try and do. You have to get a reasonable range of alternatives. Mm-hmm.
One last question.
And
I'm just kind of going by some statements in here, and I just want to make sure that has there been an approximate cost to how much this might even cost, or has that happened yet?
Madam Chair, yes, we are looking at the cost, and we're looking at funding opportunities, and I'll discuss a little bit when we get down to IUH and some other things. What we're looking at is an 18-foot-wide single-lane road with intervisible turnouts. And the turnouts are where one truck with its headlights on can see the other truck coming the other way, and there's plenty of opportunity to pull out. That's the footprint we're looking at. It might develop further than that eventually, depending on the need and such, but not under the scope of this project. Generally, we're probably looking at a $300 to $400 million project. I'll discuss IUH here in just a minute.
Sorry, when we talk about roads to resources, are we talking about a public road then that anybody could use, or are we talking about a private road just for the resource development?
Madam Chair, it could be either or. The commissioner of the department has the authority to open and close roads. We have a couple instances of that statewide. There's always pressure to open roads. There's always pressure to close roads. It's just that it'll probably be another factor in the EIS and a major factor on what kind of a access route it would be.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Let's go ahead with your – I'm sorry we took so long on this, but it was questions I think that needed to be asked and answered, and I appreciate your candor. Can we go ahead with the rest of your report?
Sure. The Ambler Road is a project. The $4 million request in this year's budget is a kickoff of the EIS. We have done a lot of preliminary engineering work and recon work. On this one, we have been able to talk to the developer quite a bit, Nova Gold, and before we get the funding, we'll go out with a procurement process and see if we can get someone on site this summer and do some field work. The Tananaw route, very exciting project for us. Mineral-rich area again. There's existing mines on site. There's other resources out there. There's rare earth resources, and the added benefit is we're connecting a community, and the community seems pretty excited about the project. I believe they see the value of road access. This will directly affect their pocketbook, and our intent with the $10 million is to get a road all the way to Tananaw. It'll be a pretty rustic road. It'll take some fixing up. There won't be a bridge crossing. That would be a very expensive project. It'll have winter access across the river in the winter, and then by ferry or boat in the summer. We've made the suggestion to the community that they should take a look at AS-2935 and think about developing a port authority where they can control the access across the river. Very exciting project for us. I think it's going to have some really good benefits for the residents out there. That's not to say we'll run into some anti-project people eventually. It's a normal case.
Wasn't there added benefit for the military to go to the area in the Tanana area? I thought there was some discussion about some open range that might be available to the military.
I haven't heard that one. I'm sure we go out to project scoping. I hope those kinds of comments come in. Okay. All comments come in, and we can take a look.
It's a different bridge.
It is a different bridge, okay. Mm-hmm. Did you have some, David?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kemp, you mentioned about somebody controlling access to a river crossing. Are you thinking there's going to be a toll bridge or something? What's going on?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. No, it would be access onto the roadway, I believe.
50 cent
toll. No, there's many ways you could do this. You could put a big gate. Well, control access.
When you say control access, are you talking about it would not be a public road?
That is one of the options. Yes.
Okay. And who would have access to it?
Well, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Greenberg. Again, it could be several functions. We don't know how this will play out or what the comments would be, but say, of course, the developers have to have access, of course. You have to get the resource in and out. You have to build a, for the UMIAT project, you have to build a pipeline. Perhaps the villages would take control of the road, ownership of the road, and they would control the in and out. The state could, the developer could. There's a variety of options, and those are the kinds of things that you would work out in the in this EIS process we're in now. I'm not sure how the comments are leaning in that regard, so we'll just have to wait and see.
Matt, please follow.
Yes, please.
Are there other roads like this that are state paid and they're not open to the public?
Representative Gruber, through the chair, yes, there are. The the one escapes me up.
Red Dog mine.
The Red Dog, and there's another one.
Pogo mine.
About 20 miles of the access road into Pogo is will become open to the public when the mine closes, but the remaining mileage, the remaining 30 miles, will always remain closed. That kind of agreement there, and then of course the Red Dog is
just one more.
Sure, absolutely, Representative.
Would this go to the village of Tanana, this particular road?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, this project would go to the other side of the river on Tanana. This project, we would, I'm sorry, I was thinking we were talking about UMIAT or Ambler.
I thought we were talking about Tanana.
Well, I was at the start, but I don't think there'd be restrictions on that road. That road, the community wants access with that road.
And for Ambler, would that go to the village of Ambler?
Into the general area, into the mining district where the sulfide mines are.
I want to be sure that people in the villagers would have some access. I mean, I don't live there, but it seems to me important that the people there, particularly if they don't have a lot of money, would be able to have the money to drive to and from their village.
Mm-hmm. Representative Johnson, yes. After you. Go ahead. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering, doesn't the Alaska Railroad already go to Tanana? And if they do, they don't.
Representative,
in the vicinity, but not exactly there.
No, Representative Petersburg.
In the Indiana.
Oh, okay.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, good.
I get mixed up too.
Representative Figge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the governor announced the Tanana Road, kind of caught me by surprise. I hadn't heard any buzz about this ahead of time, which is normally the case. Do you guys envision this as sort of a standalone road in and of itself to, you know, improve the utility of the Yukon River as a transportation highway of and by itself, or is this sort of a stepping stone and kind of complementary to the road to Ambler? Or to the Ambler Mining District?
Representative Feige, through the chair, in our minds, this is a road to Tanana. We're accessing resource-rich area, and it also happens to connect the community. Now, there's no doubt that it's a derivative of the Western Access Study. Yes. There's no denying that. But this is one that brings instant results and brings in commerce. The river part of it, I'm not sure. I know the barge landings are at Nanana now, and perhaps they'll move to Tanana. I don't know. That's the kind of information that will be looked at in the EIS.
Is the water depth where you intend to bring the road to? Is it suitable for landing heavier barges, or is there a suitable bank there to construct, or to simply use as a port facility?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I've heard that, but nothing. I don't believe we have any engineering to back that up. I heard that the little island on the south side of the river is a good port facility, but I don't know. I would hate to comment at that.
Thank you. Let's go ahead with your report.
OK. Okay, the Klondike IUH, that's the industrial use highway regulations we have, a statute we have. And what that, well, actually, it's the next slide. Let me get into this a little bit. This is when the Faro mine started in the Yukon Territory, they were trucking large ore shipments to Skagway. And the department at that time did not have the facilities in place to accommodate the heavy loads. These were what we call 160,000-pound B-train loads, the cupcakes containers. And so in 85, we instituted the IUH regulations. It's the only highway in the state. We do get a toll on it. We receive a toll from the developers, and that toll goes back into the highway where we improve the highway to take it to a standard higher than a normal highway. In other words, we could build to our usual standard to accommodate all the Hondas and the Chevys, but when we're talking these huge trucks, we need thicker pavements, we need stronger bridges. We used the money successfully to renovate the Captain William Moore Bridge. You might have seen pictures of it. It's a cantilevered bridge across the gully to increase the pavement depth. In fact, to put a shop up near the pass to store equipment. So this has been a very good use of a toll facility. It's been in place for 25 years. The rates are also 25 years old. They're very much out of date. And what we found with the explosion of mining opportunities in the Yukon, we were at the Vancouver AME summit last week. Skagway is definitely the port of egress for the ore and also ingress for the supplies. There's just no doubt about it. We wanted to confirm that. But what we're doing is we're getting ahead of the game. We're going to we're going to get rid of our little tinker toy bridge that was built in 77 or 76. We're going to fill in the gully. We're going to put in a thicker pavement, and we're going to make the road more accommodating to 200,000-pound vehicles. These vehicles are going to drive 700 miles from the Selwyn mine to Skagway. Then it's going to go on, the ore is going to go on a ship and go 7,000 miles to China. A big increase in traffic. This particular project, we do have the ability to revisit our regs and our tolls, and we can take care of business with that particular roadway. It's only a 15-mile stretch of highway. The Yukon government has far bigger problems than we do with this ore transport. They're looking at over a $500 million bill to bring their highways up to standards, and then they only bring in $60,000 a year on their trucking, their toll rate. Mm-hmm. It's a penny a kilogram a mile, not a penny a kilometer a mile. So we have a great opportunity here. Now, we're under the impression that the funding, the Federal Highway Administration wouldn't participate in the funding to bring it to that higher standard, and that's so we requested $2.5 million to do that, and I think that's a good use of money. Now, dialing back to the other roads to resources, this is a tool we can use on any of the resource roads. I don't know if it'll work on Umiat. There's some oil tax implications there. I don't know about that. But the road to Ambler certainly looks like a good candidate for an IUH. We have a willing partner in Nova Gold to participate in the cost of that road, and an IUH scheme might be the way to go. Very, very good opportunity to take care of our highways for the industrial use with this strategy.
I see. Yes, Commissioner Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Say Nova Gold helps you pay for the road and its industrial use highway going into its mine site. Obviously, if there's a road there, it makes more projects within a certain radius. Makes them more economic, so one would expect that there'd be further mining development along that corridor. Much like a pipeline is set up as a, either a contract line or a common carrier line, what is there, are there already provisions in the industrial use highway statutes that allow for buy-in of new new operators or new industrial users?
Representative Feige, through the chair, those are exactly the types of problems we have to deal with. We could have a scenario where a developer comes to the table with a significant amount of cash. Well, what happens when he puts up the upfront cash and then we have another player come in years later or 2 years later? And that would be the beauty of IUH. We could have a sliding scale for the first developer. We could with Skagway, this is how it worked. AML, Linden, actually participated up front, and I think it was $1 million or something like that. They gave us $1 million to upgrade Skagway, and then they had free passage, the Klondike Highway. They had free passage since then. They don't pay any tolls on the Klondike. Now, the agreement was that would last until the facilities became the useful life was out, and that's where we're at now. But that's exactly the type of thing we're going to have to work out with a funding program. And I hear what you're saying. I thought the same things. We have to everyone has to pay their full share, and it might be a diminishing amount for the person first to the plate. I'll switch to the regular highway program now and talk about some things we did this past year to enhance our project development. Alaska has been receiving about $450 million in federal aid from the Highway Trust Fund. This is a fund that's funded with gas tax receipts, federal gas tax receipts, 18 cents for gas, 24 cents for diesel, I believe. And we've been getting our share. We are a donee state. We receive about $5 to $6 of federal aid versus what we put in to the into the trust fund. It's been very good to us. About $220 million of this goes to our what we would call our commerce roads, and what we've been calling our commerce corridor, the Seward, the Glen, the Parks, and the Dalton are good examples of our NHS system, our national highway system. And those are the roads that we've kind of been focusing on to take the brunt of this funding and get them up to a good enough shape from both a safety standpoint and a commerce standpoint. With federal aid, the next slide comes a litany of regulations that we don't have on the state side of things. I put those boxes up there, and you can see when we became a state in 59, when the curve took a huge turn upwards. And these are all the laws, regulations, rules we have to follow on the federal highway NEPA side of things. You've probably heard of subjects like 4F and 106 and permit, core permits, and all of these are in here. And this is what we have to go through to put a project on the street. And the point I was making here was, in 59, when we became a state, we're really the only state that's had to put up with, not put up, but has had to deal with this amount of regulatory oversight to get our basic transportation footprint on the ground. We're a resource-rich, access-poor state, and with this curve, you can see why. We were a state for 5 years, and the earthquake hit. Well, our funding emphasis went to fix things that the earthquake took down. We were getting back on our feet, and the floods in Fairbanks hit, and that took a significant amount of our funding to take care of the roads damage in that event. I've got down here 68. That was the highway bill in 68, where it went to more of an urban emphasis rather than a rural emphasis, and we took a hit there. And then, of course, NEPA, where the processes were adopted by the agencies for EIS development and permitting and such. So really a tough thing to follow with our with the federal aid process. The bill is up. The new highway bill is up now in the both the Senate and the House. The Senate version is a two-year bill. The funding is remaining the same nationwide, but the allocations to the state are not known at this time. So we don't know how we're affected by that. The House bill, we know we're seriously affected with the proposed bill. We're going to take a hit of about $150 million if it goes through as it is. This is a third of our program. Major impacts to our roadways and the things we have to do and our needs. We have over $20 billion worth of needs if you gather everything together and look at it in that regard. We have 25% of our national highway roads are sitting on permafrost. Well, if we ever want to fix the whoop-de-doos, that's about a $2 billion bill. About 27% of our NHS system doesn't have adequate width. And that's a huge cost. Our bridge programs is something we're looking at of $60 million a year. So these types of things, and plus the mega projects, are really really going to be affected by a downturn with what we do get from Congress. Now, luckily, we were on top of this, but we were on top of it from another view. The Highway Trust Fund distributes about $42 billion a year to the highway program nationwide. The trust fund was bringing in about $28 billion from tax receipts, gas tax receipts. So early on, we were looking at a third cut. It was just coincidental. But we were taking a worst-case scenario, and we were saying, okay, well, we're in trouble. We could be in trouble here if we take this big of a hit. What are we going to do with what we have in our planning and so forth? So we started looking at what we could do with state funds intermixed with federal aid, and we took this on about June of this year. And what we found is that Alaska, about 70% of our highway funding comes from the federal government. And then what surprised us, and I didn't know this, was that other states have their state-funded programs, and they only use about 20% federal aid. Now, they have dedicated funds like gas taxes or other types of funding sources, and we don't do that. We take it out of our general fund program. But this was with 70%, you can see how we're impacted even more. No one is taking the hit that Alaska's taking in the House version of this highway bill. We stand out like a sore thumb on this. We're getting whacked good. And we know we had a history of using general funds instead of federal aid before. And I gave you a couple examples here. And Elmore Road in Anchorage, you know, that was a roadway constructed on virgin ground. And that would have been a very difficult project for us to develop under the federal aid process. Doing it with state general funds, we know we saved about $15 million on the project, and we were able to deliver it a lot faster. The other example, so that was a project built with general funds, no federal aid involved. The second project is a project out here at Sunny Point in Juneau. That was a project that was built with federal aid and federal aid dollars. And the reason I'm bringing this up is if you go by that intersection and you look at all the tall walls and stuff, that added a lot of cost to the project. And the reason those walls are in there, and you'll see, you'll notice a little bit of changes in the engineering as you go through. But that was to avoid the Mendenhall Refuge wetland, or the park out there, that is what we call a 4F property. And under the state process, there is no 4F. So we could have saved $3.4 million, our estimate, if we would have used general funds on that project instead of federal aid. That's another project. That's a 4 or 5 mile paving project somewhere else in the state that we could have saved. So we looked at those, and we looked at some other processes. And The ATP process for federal projects is it's a process where you work in series. You can't do anything until you finish the first box. And a good example is that I like to use is when you have a 10-mile section of road and you know you have to replace a bridge, well, you can't begin work on that bridge, the design of that bridge, until you're done with the environmental document. You know a bridge is going to go there, you know the width, you know the length, but you can't work on it until you. So what we proposed in this year's budget was a project acceleration account, $2.5 million, and what that does, that lets us work outside the ATP process. We will work, we will design that bridge during the environmental document, we will buy right away during the design phase if it became available, those types of things. And we estimated that we could save $5 to $10 million a year just on that. This is a conservative estimate. We think it's more, but we're trying to play this thing straight because these are some pretty serious decisions we have to make to move forward with the highway program. The next slide was very interesting to us too. We took a look at what the legislature allocated to the Departments of Transportation and Commerce, and that those are two agencies are get the brunt of funds for highway construction and road construction, and we do put a lot of money towards our roads and highways in Alaska, to the tune of about $250 million a year when you average it out. About $180 million comes through us. About $70 million goes through Commerce. Now, we've got a real good handle on what comes to us. They're named projects. We know that. Going through the Department of Commerce is the information from them. We're not so sure we've got an exact number. Anything that looked like a road, we put it in there, and just trying to get an idea of how much Alaska does put into their highways from on a capital standpoint. And The one thing that is an issue with us is the up and down funding. If it was a steady stream of funding, it would be more helpful to us. And the other thing is that when the legislature comes in with projects, I don't think there's the coordination that goes on between what can we use our general funds for to leverage our federal aid. In other words, we don't sit down with the legislature over a project they might want to put forward and sit down and try and figure out, well, what's the best way to do this to save money and time? And that's something I think that we should take a look at and try and try and leverage our federal aid and their funding. And the next slide kind of did it. What we tend to do, and this is a very general term, not. I know we have done some things to address tougher projects, but in very general terms, we seem to take the hardest to develop money, the federal aid money, and put it to the hardest to develop projects, and then we take the easiest to develop money, state funds, and we put it to the easiest projects, and we should try and reverse that. We should be trying to do more pavement overlays with our federal aid dollars and then going through 4F areas with our state funds. And it's just a common sense type of thing. And we think we can save a significant amount of funding if we do that. And so what we did, we went one more step, and I asked the regions, give me your projects that you think are very difficult to develop. 4F, difficult right-of-ways, 106 process, anything like that. Tell me what they are, and tell me what you think they'll cost if we use federal aid, and tell me what you think they'll cost if we use non-federal aid. And the savings were significant. This was just a straw man that we put together, but it looks like we could save about 15% of our federal aid. And what that is generally, that's eliminating a lot of study of things and a lot of capital costs that have to go in to mitigate areas, well, like the walls out here at Sunny Point. And we believe that we could stretch our dollar with the a good look at our general funds and using them a little bit better and in a way that leverages our federal aid. I didn't put the times on this chart. There is, we did include the value of the dollar on this, so that was something to consider in the cost savings. We also did not include societal costs, that, you know, a major safety corridor and saving a life because we made a safety improvement. But I think this is something we'd really like to work with the legislature on when they develop their capital programs, and I think we could make some real inroads to improving our system and help mitigate the impact we are probably going to feel from our loss of federal aid. And that's all I had today.
Thank you, Mr. Kemp. Any questions? Yes, Representative Wilson.
If I hear you right, Pat, it sounds to me like maybe in the long run it would also save some money for our communities with some of the projects that they might have.
Madam Chair, yes, it would. Now, with these projects, we only looked at projects dear to our heart, our NHS and our AHS system. We did not look at the community transportation program, but I am sure that there are some CTP projects that would go a lot further if we leveraged the federal aid there too.
Yeah. Representative Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm all for saving money on projects and getting them done. There's no doubt of that, and I can only speak for the Fairbanks area. I'm extremely concerned since I've been in office about the amount of time projects take, and I understand the federal requirements, and I look at your various hoops that have to be jumped through or requirements that exist, and I understand it's easy to complain or about issues and things, but I know some projects that have been on the books for such a period of time that their costs have tripled, quadrupled, or whatever, and we're designing and redesigning them, and generally what I hear is that it is the acquisition of properties that takes so long to do the projects, and that's worn rather thin with me as far as, you know, that being an excuse. And I would just appreciate, you know, we built a brand new building for engineering in Fairbanks, and still the projects stumble along, and some of them it seems like it's only the ones that the department or whoever's leading the department has a priority for that the projects move forward. And I've raised the issue with you guys about my favorite little bike path that has basically almost the same design cost for a mile of bike path as does a 12-mile road being rebuilt, which makes absolutely no sense to me. Those kind of figures, $800,000 in design, is the equivalent of having five people work for an entire year to design a project or something. Just beyond me, you know. And it's like people think you're stupid or something, because I've taken, and I've told you this too, I've taken engineers from companies, construction companies out there, and they just laughed at the thought of what not only the overall cost was, but the time frame that it was taken to design something, or even, you know, and it's just ridiculous after a while. You know, I mean, it just, so no wonder things are so costly when we're taking that kind of time to work them out. And like I said, I understand the federal part, and I can accept some of that, but even at that, it just seems somewhat unbelievable that the projects, even with the federal situation, take as long as they do. And with that, you know, I guess if we're going to look potentially forward to losing federal money, I would encourage the Department of Transportation to take the initiative to support a transportation fund for the state of Alaska if we're going to have to replace that kind of money. And encourage the governor to take, you know, the similar stance, or at least to promote an idea that has been raised in both the House and the Senate as far as putting forth something that will spin off money on an annual basis that could potentially at least offset some of the federal money, or save us money if in fact, you know, we're spending somebody else's money anyhow, and it's federal money, so I guess that's not the biggest deal. You know, I mean, it's unfortunate that that's the way it is. But if we can speed up saving our money, that would be appreciated, and put something in place that helps us develop some of these roads that we talk about year after year after year after year. So anyhow, just a comment more so than a question.
Thank you. I appreciate that comment. We do have 25 minutes left, and we still have two presenters. Pat has taken us a little bit more time than I thought we would. I appreciate the information, though.
Okay.
But we should move on and get the other two before we run out of time. The commissioner might, next commissioner might. And we have now from the Alaska Marine Highway System, Deputy Commissioner Mr. Newsom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Michael Musil, the Deputy Commissioner for Marine Operations with the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And as we get our presentation up here. What I would like to talk to you about this afternoon is on the agenda there. Last class fair procurement status was, I think, the requested topic. I would also like to briefly touch on our website, the 511 system, some requests for new service, and some dock issues. And since those are all pretty disjoint topics, please stop me at any time for questions. I'd be happy to take them. Next, please. The OSC class ferry is a procurement process most of you are familiar with. I think this is a conceptual drawing of what that ship will look like. It is not fully designed yet. It is still in the design process. Next, these would be bullet points. So just a brief history. There have been two $60 million general fund appropriations into the vessel replacement fund. One of those appropriated to the DOT, and in this year's budget, in the governor's budget, is a request to appropriate the second $60 million from the vessel replacement fund to DOT, bringing the total to $120 million, less what we've spent for the 10% or so design that we've gotten so far. That $120 million is based on an estimate that's a couple years old, and predates some of the decisions that have been made in the project. So I would urge caution in saying that $120 million is a fully funded Alaska class ferry. I don't believe that it is, but the process will define what the ultimate cost of that vessel will be and how we fund that. The legislative intent in the first appropriation of $60 million was very clear, and that was that that vessel should be built in the state of Alaska unless the commissioner of DOT determined that for some reason it could not or was not in the state's best interest to do so. Recently, as part of the procurement process development, the commissioner, in fact, found that it was in the state's best interest to procure that vessel within the state of Alaska. And a best interest finding memo was written to document that after the Attorney General's office reviewed the procurement proposal put forth by the department on how to procure that vessel. Next, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Huggins.
I would just like to congratulate the department for that finding. You know, there's a lot of debate around here about regional, who makes money, is it cost effective, what have you. And, you know, investing Alaska's money in Alaska is an important concept, and I just congratulate you, Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, on that. It's important for Alaskans.
Through the Chair, Senator Huggins, thank you for that. I want to give just a real brief overview of the construction manager general contractor overview. As you know, I've been with DOT just under a year, and for the first 6 to 8 months of my tenure here, the big focus was how are we going to procure this vessel? What method are we going to use? And there's really three types of procurement, and I want to briefly cover them so that you all understand and hopefully can support the method that was chosen to go forward with this. You're all familiar with low bid, basically a design bid build. We would hire somebody to design the vessel. We would put it out for bids, take the low bid. Whoever bid the lowest would build it. That's one process that has been used a lot. We've gotten a lot of vessels that via that method. But that method has some problems, and the biggest problem is that as soon as you award that bid to the lowest bidder, you set up an adversarial relationship. The lowest bidder is then interested in making back the money that he perhaps underbid that project at to get the bid in order to make a profit and to make things work. So you set up an adversarial relationship, not necessarily the best in terms of a business environment to have both people come out with the same outcome. The next generation of that is a design-build project, and we've had ships built using that method, the Kennecott, for example. wherein the owner or the state lists a set of requirements. What does the ship have to do? What does it have to carry? How fast does it go? What sea state can it operate in? You define all the requirements. You advertise those requirements, and shipyards bid on those requirements to build a vessel unspecified by the state that will meet all those requirements, and that's how the project goes. That also has problems in that if you forget very important things in those initial design specifications, you end up with a ship that doesn't meet your requirements. And as ideal as we would like to be to think that we know all of the requirements and can put them on a piece of paper up front, we don't necessarily know that. And I think the Kennecott's a good example. I've heard the story from the chief contracts officer that he went down for the commissioning of the ship, stepped off the gangway onto the ship, and stepped in a big puddle of water and said, gee, why is there a puddle of water on the deck? Well, it's because we forgot to mention that we should camber the decks because it operates in a rainy environment. It's built in Mississippi, not necessarily a big deal. They had a rainstorm the night before. So design build does have some inherent weaknesses as well. The latest generation, and what we hope to do with the Alaska Class Ferry, is do a construction manager general contractor process, whereby we identify a general contractor ahead of time, in this case Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, to work with the state as the owner and the designer, Elliott Bay Design Group, to jointly design and hopefully construct the Alaska Class Ferry in a cooperative as opposed to a competitive manner with each other. We think that has some advantages. That model has been used at least 14 times, I think, throughout the state of Alaska in the CMGC process. The State Crime Lab, for example, was built using a CMGC process, came in on time, under budget, very successful project. The Alaska Class Ferry is the first time that we're trying to use CMGC for a shipboard, ship construction type of project. All the other ones have been roads or buildings type of projects. So it's new, and that will come into play here when you ask about how long it's taking to get the Alaska Class Ferry started, because it's new. Next, please. So what we hope... What we hope to achieve, the first step of that is phase one, a professional services agreement with Alaska Class.
Yes. Just want to remind you, and I think I said earlier that we're going to be adjourning at 3 o'clock. I noticed how many pages you have here, and I think you have to be a little bit mindful of, if you want to save all the information before, then you might have to cut a few of your corners.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Couple of steps. Phase one, a professional services agreement will bring Alaska Ship and Dry Dock on board as a partner with Elliott Bay Design Group and the state. Next slide, please. To form that partnership between those three entities, the department, Elliott Bay Design Group, and Alaska Ship and Dry Dock. And that will lead to hopefully a guaranteed maximum price proposal by Alaska Ship and Dry Dock to say, hey, we've been involved with the design of this ship from the get-go, basically. And we propose that we can build that ship for you for X number of dollars. If the state and Alaska Ship and Dry Dock can agree on a guaranteed maximum price proposal, then phase two happens and we award a construction contract to Alaska Ship and Dry Dock to build that ship. If we can't come to an agreement on the guaranteed maximum price, there are escape clauses. The state or Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, for that matter, can at any time through the process say, hey, not working out, we can't come to a price agreement, we're not capable of building the ship, whatever it might be. In which case we take the design out and we just bid the design out and go back to a design bid build process. So there are escape clauses to the procurement method that we have chosen. Timeline-wise, we are currently putting the finishing touches, and it's taken longer than I would have hoped, but there's reasons for that. We're putting the finishing touches on the professional services agreement to get Alaska Ship and Dry Dock officially on board as a partner with us. That has just come back from the Attorney General's office with a final review. We will be presenting that to Alaska Ship and Dry Dock shortly to bring them on board. That's the overview on the Alaska Class Ferry. I'm going to change gears to the website vessel tracking system. This is a new initiative that many of you are aware of. Marine Highway System started on our website a public 24/7 public access information system to provide the public information on where their ferries are. Previously, after hours, the reservation center is closed. If there's not a ship in port, the terminals are frequently closed. It's very difficult to reach somebody to figure out, hey, when's the ferry that's supposed to be here at 10 o'clock going to get here if it's late? There's now several methods available to do that. The first is the website, and I'll mention it's an award-winning website now. We submitted the Marine Highway System designers for this for the Public Relations Society of America Award, and they won third place in website design for this website. So kudos to my staff down at Ketchikan for doing this in-house. But if the – can you go back one slide, please? I'm hopeful that the system will work, and we'll just give you a quick live demo. and it's not going to work. Sorry. I was hoping to go online and see what that actually looked like and show you that.
That's why I only got third place.
Well, I hope that's not the reason we got third place, but you never know. Maybe they tried it and it didn't work either. In any event, you can see from the background picture there, the ships are located, the communities are located. If you click on either the ship or the community, it brings up additional information about that ship, about that community. We hope to do some marketing information for the communities, what events are going on in those communities via the website as well. Next. There's two other methods of getting information about the Marine Highway System. One is the 511 system, the state's traveler information system, typically thought of for road systems and road closures and accidents and weather reports. The Marine Highway System is now included on that. It is a voice-activated system. When it answers, you say, I want to talk about the Marine Highway System, and it'll give you the opportunity to list a port and list a ship, and it'll tell you, based on the same information that's on the website you saw previously, when that ship will arrive at various ports, schedule information, those types of things. And then the last, back one, please. The last method of getting information is really a push system rather than a pull system. If people subscribe to the Gov delivery system, and that's tailorable, you can select what type of information you want to get from Gov delivery. I want ferry schedule information, and I want information about ferry sales. That specific type of information, every time we publish a Gov delivery about a schedule change or a weather delay or anything, we'll automatically send an email to the subscribers that have selected those categories. So it's a push information system. We have two pending requests for new service on the Marine Highway System. One is from the village of Ozinki, located just to the north of Kodiak Island on Spruce Island. They are, in fact, on an island and not accessible to the community of Kodiak. The ferry Tustamina sails by them often every time it goes to Port Lyons, which is on the other side of the island there. It sails right by their front door. Heretofore, we have not been able to go to Ozinki because the dock was not capable of handling the Tustamina. The community has since built a new dock, which is compatible. Water is sufficient, and the dock is compatible for handling the Tustamina. They have officially requested Marine Highway service, both from the community, the Native Corporation, and the Tribal Corporation in Ozinki. And we have a plan in place to start providing service there as soon as the finishing touches are put on the pier in terms of fendering. Tentatively, we'll start in early springtime, March, April, May, depending when the fenders get there and get installed. Tustamina will plan to call there every other Friday with a morning arrival, get folks to Kodiak. They'll have 6.5 hours on deck in Kodiak, and then an afternoon departure out of Kodiak going back to Ozinki. So I have been engaged with the community personally. We did a community survey. There is overwhelming support for providing service to Ozinki. We think we can do it at virtually no cost to the system since the ship is running anyway. It's just a matter of pulling in there where we sail right by anyway. And we're concerned a bit about competition with air carriers that do provide service to Ozinki. I've contacted both air carriers that go to that community and tried to seek their opinion of what they would think about Marine Highways going there. Is that viewed as competition or is that viewed as good? And kind of to my surprise, both of them were overwhelmingly supportive of having us go there. What's good for that community is good for the air carriers, in their opinion. So nothing but positive support for us starting that service there this spring.
Representative Wilson has a question for you.
For the route, does the on the map, on the map I'm looking at, does the ferry go right through there anyway?
The ferry goes through that strait anyway. Yes, ma'am. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, from Kodiak to Port Lyons on the opposite side of the island, they literally sail by the front door of Ozinki every time they make that route.
Cool. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any other communities like that on any of your other routes?
Through the chair to Representative Gruenberg. No, sir, not yet. There's no other communities that we go by that have a dock capable of us going there that have requested service.
Without a dock?
Without a dock, we'll get to the next one here in just a moment, which is Old Harbor. And that's the next request for service, and it's a little more challenging, and I'll explain that in just a moment. Our second request for new service is the community of Old Harbor, located south of Kodiak on the eastern side of the island. And as I just mentioned, we do not sail by there routinely. In fact, we rarely, if ever, go down that direction. We usually go on the backside of Kodiak Island through Shilikoff Strait when we run down the Aleutian chain. Next bullet, please. So the community of Old Harbor has made an official request. They have a new municipal dock that is just completed as well, that is capable of handling both the Tustamina and the Kennecott. They got information from Marine Highways, worked with their engineers to design that dock specifically to be able to handle both of those ships in sufficient water. Next. We are still exploring the possible service options. I just met with the delegation from Old Harbor yesterday. They came to town to talk about this request. Again, very interested in it. They think it's economically viable for the community and will economically develop the community to have ferry service there. We think we can provide service. Thank you. We think we can provide service to the community of Old Harbor. It will come at a cost, but it's not a cost in terms of dollars. And let me explain that. The Tustamina in the summertime, actually year-round, runs all the time. It's not a matter of, you know, with some more money we can add some more weeks of service on Tustamina. It's already fully utilized. The cost to provide service to a community like Old Harbor or any other community that's off the current network is a cost in terms of service to other communities. What community will lose some service in order for Old Harbor to gain service? And then the decision is that loss of service someplace else so severe that it's untenable, or is it a reduction in service but not an elimination of basic service? Our mandate is to provide basic transportation services to really as many communities as we can. In my opinion, it's not an exclusive club. If you have ferry service now, you continue to have it. If you don't have ferry service now, you'll never get it. I don't believe is the way that we should manage your system. So we're looking at Old Harbor. We're looking at options for how to do that, and think that with some minor adjustments to the Aleutian chain runs, we can provide some service to that community that will be satisfactory to them and beneficial to them. And again, difficult due to the location.
Has a question for you. Sorry. Thank you.
How long does it take to make that from Kodiak over to Old Harbor? Because that would be fuel that's used that we don't usually use. Or would you go to the Aleutian straight from Old Harbor then?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Yes, ma'am. It will be an additional fuel cost slightly. Actually, going on one side of Kodiak Island versus going on the other side is only like 15 to 20 nautical miles different in terms of run distance. The trick with Old Harbor is, if you could go back to the slide where it actually shows the map where you can see it. The trick with Old Harbor is you cannot get in, our ships anyway, cannot get into Old Harbor from the north and the east. Sitka-Litic Strait on the north and east is too shallow. Our ships will have to go down around the southern tip of Sitka-Litic Island and back up from the south. A little bit longer on the runtime, not impossible. And if you're coming from the Aleutian chain, that's the direction you're coming from anyway. So we're looking at options for how to provide service there that meld with the Tustamina running down the chain and back.
It's
kind of
like Sitka. I'm thinking it's kind of like Sitka, where you have to go on around and then back up again.
Yes, ma'am. Geography is our is our challenge.
Yep.
Representative Bloomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is my recollection right that sometimes the weather is pretty tough in Shelikoff Straits? And would it at some times be potentially easier to take the southern route rather than the northern route through Shelikoff Straits?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. Yes, sir. The weather in Shelikoff Straits can be more severe than outside at times. Actually, I personally experienced that in the helicopter. It just depends on where the weather system is and which way the wind happens to be blowing and how much fetch there is. So. I think, and I mentioned this to the representatives from Old Harbor that I met with yesterday, regardless of what schedule we set, there will be disruptions due to weather on this run, as there are right now with our Aleutian chain service. We occasionally bypass ports because the weather just precludes us from getting into them. Okay, new issue. We have, I tried to make a quote on it up there, ships alone do not make a ferry system. Unless you can get people on and off them safely, you don't really have a good system. You have some ships. So docks are a big issue for us. I want to highlight a couple of successes and then a couple of challenges just to make you aware of them. And I realize we have limited time, so I will breeze through this. Click on the Angoon.
Oh,
whoops. Back. These are hot links. Just click on the Angoon. In Angoon, we have completely rebuilt the dock structure there. with a brand new facility that looks like that, which is very useful and highly functional. The design trick here is that due to non-standardization of our ships, we need a dock that has the ability to handle various classes of ships. For example, when the Leconte backs into this dock and unloads, the Leconte has a stern ramp, so the ramp you see that's kind of dipping down in the water right there actually folds down into the water out of the way, so the Leconte stern ramp can drop onto the kind of black triangle on the ramp, so the Leconte can berth there. However, when the Leconte's gone and the Fairweather pulls in there, the Fairweather does not have a stern ramp on the ship, so the ramp that's in the water folds up, Fairweather backs in, and that ramp will drop onto the stern of the Fairweather. So it can handle both classes of ships. Very functional, new facility, and it is a success. We appreciate the support and the funding for that. I think the community of Angoon is very happy with that facility, and we have negotiated actually an agreement with the Alaska Marine Line Barge Company to actually bring propane into the community through that facility as well, since there is no adequate barge landing in Angoon. So all those issues taken care of. I think Angoon is a success, and it's not on my radar scope of things to worry about anymore. HUNA is also a success, a new terminal building and a new dock facility, also compatible with both classes of ships, fast ferries and conventional displacement hulls. You'll notice that there's no catwalks between the dolphins out there on the mooring on the bottom of the picture. That's because that is a self-mooring facility. The ship pulls up close to it. You see the little antenna-looking thing sticking up above each of those dolphins. The ship gets close enough that the crew reaches over with a boat hook, pulls in that cable from the dolphin and moors themselves. We don't need line handlers out there to do that. So some labor savings and some good ship handling by the crews to get in there and actually snag those lines and get tied up properly. Next. Some of our challenges. Chignik is one of the challenging docks. If you go to the next slide for just a second. The Tustamina moors at Chignik across the end of two docks, West Dock and East Dock. The challenge out there is that neither of those docks is owned by a municipality. It's owned by a private company, Trident Seafoods. I got a disturbing phone call from a Trident Seafoods lawyer asking me why I was doing unauthorized dockings of Marine Highway vessels at the Trident Seafoods dock in Chignik, to which I responded, I didn't realize I was doing that, but we have an issue. So we are engaged with Trident Seafoods to try and arrange a use agreement, which we've tried before and were unsuccessful at, and now try to do a lease agreement to be able to continue to use those docks. That's still being negotiated. It's not a certainty yet, and there is no municipal dock in Chignik for us to go to. So it's this dock really or nothing in terms of ferry service for the community of Chignik.
Representative Wilson has a question.
You know, how much money extra now that we're going to have to pay somebody that above what we're doing now?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I don't know yet. We have not negotiated numbers. I have a draft lease agreement that I propose to send to Trident here shortly after I get my final review on it. But we're proposing to lease a dock that is in fairly sad shape. The inset picture that you can see there is a folding ruler stuck through the piling that's underneath that dock. So the facility itself is not in great shape. Trident has actually offered to sell that to the state of Alaska and have it be our ferry terminal, and we
but they do.
And
they
we have so far declined to do that. So we're actually in a bit of a conundrum. We need to have a dock there, and that's really the only dock that's available for use, and it's not in great shape, and there's liability issues and all types of things that we're dealing with in that facility. So my goal is to be able to continue to provide service to Chignik. We're going to see if we can make that happen. You may hear otherwise if we are unsuccessful in negotiating a lease agreement with Trident on that.
Yes.
I would appreciate on this and the other challenges if you could let the committees know the progress on that, if that's okay with the chair. I'd like to follow up not only from behalf of this committee but on behalf of the Judiciary Committee, because there may be some legal things that we need to be concerned about. I would like to see us negotiate this to a win.
Can I ask you to sum up? We're just about out of time here, and I don't want to cut you short, but if you could sum up, it would be great.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I can do that. Last one I'll cover, and the other ones we'll skip. Cordova, as you know, we have a $1.2 million supplemental request in the budget this year. The Cordova dock, next slide, please. The Cordova dock was designed on those, it's built out of those blue floats that you see the gentleman in that picture standing on. Those are called flexi floats. They are basically like Lego blocks. You stick them together, make them whatever shape you want, build the dock, and then build a bunch of infrastructure on top of it to build the roadway for cars and people to get on. Unfortunately, in Cordova, it's exposed, and during certain storm conditions, it flexes. And it flexes at those pivot points, and we've seen some cracking. And those floats, which are basically barges, started taking on water, and our dock structure was sinking. So we instituted an emergency repair to try and fix that, mobilized the contractor to do that. And unfortunately, in the middle of the contractor being mobilized to fix that, a major storm hit, which is what we'd feared would happen, and it did additional damage. Some of the superstructure of the dock started coming apart. Bottom line is, after $1.2 million and a lot of emergency repairs, the girders, if I could just point in the thing here. Can you go back one? The girders along the side right here. Boy, I can't do this inside. This girder right here is like a 5-foot high I-beam that was attached to the side on both sides of that structure to stiffen it so that it didn't bend. And you see the internal stiffeners in the gaps in between those floats were added as well to stiffen that facility and hopefully prevent it from coming apart in the next storm. So that's what that $1.2 million supplemental request is for. The dock is secure. We're back to using it as normal, but it was closed there for a while. We thought it was actually going to sink. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will take any questions and conclude my remarks.
Are we have any questions from members of the committee? Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment to say thanks for – I noticed that you recognized Mr. Tim Doggett, the commissioner did, as the Southeast Employee of the Year for the region, and that's important. There are four other people here that are also recognized important. One, a question on ship and dry dock. They're under new ownership now. I assume that gives them a more robust capability, but could you give us any thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, yes, sir. Actually, I was made aware about 2 hours ago that there is a pending proposal for Alaska Ship and Dry Dock to be acquired by Vigor Shipyards. As you may or may not know, Vigor Shipyards owns most of the shipyards in the Pacific Northwest, taking over the previous Cascade General Shipyard in Portland, Todd Shipyard in Seattle, and various other entities. So Vigor Shipyard is the predominant shipyard now in the Pacific Northwest, and it appears that they're expanding into Alaska. I don't know the details of that agreement, actually, nor do I know the impact or implications that it may have for the Marine Highway System, since Alaska Ship and Dry Dock is our main provider of services for state overhauls.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, we did have Mr. David Levy from the Mobility Coalition who was supposed to be here. It worked out very well for us because we had so much of a presentation today. He was not available this afternoon, so we're going to have to reschedule him for some other time. With that, I'll close the committee hearing, and I thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Thank you, members of the committee of the House and the Senate, for being here, and have a good afternoon. We are adjourned.
And for the House members.